You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Thanks for joining us today for our program entitled Stopping North Korea, Inc., Sanctions Effectiveness and Unintended Consequences. I'm Richard Bush. I'm the director of the Center for East Asia Policy Studies here at Brookings. And we have an all-star lineup here to talk about this issue. I'm really impressed that such a large audience would come out for such a granular topic when there are other things going on in town. It shows your dedication. I'm really looking forward to the presentations. Sanctions are things that we, as the United States, do to make ourselves feel good, but that's not really the purpose. The purpose is to make the other guy feel bad. But the question is a factual one. Do the other guys feel bad? We have some of the best people here to talk about that. John Park. He's a faculty affiliate at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard. Jim Walsh is a research associate at the Center for International Studies at the Massachusetts Institute for Technology. And then my colleague, Jonathan Pollock, who's a senior fellow here at Brookings and the interim SK Korea Foundation Chair in Korea Studies. You couldn't ask for a better set of people to talk about this issue than that. So with that, I'm going to get out of the way. And let's see. Invite John and Jim to come up and do their presentation.
Good afternoon, friends. Thank you for coming. John and I are going to play a little tag team, try to keep you awake. I'll do a few slides. He'll do a few slides. We'll probably contradict each other, but that's okay. You know, Richard mentioned what a terrific turnout it is, and I want to thank Richard and Jonathan for having us here. It's always terrific to be at this august institution and with so many smart people. We're really looking forward to getting some feedback. This is an ongoing project. 3 years now, we've been interviewing North Korean defectors who work for state trading companies, the organizations that do procurement, the organizations whose job is to beat sanctions. And I expect that John Park is going to continue this research. So we want to hear from you, and we can take it. You know, I when we were on tour, as it were, I told our audiences, you know, criticize, go after us, doesn't matter, you know. I'm used to it. My children and my wife criticize me every day, and I can take it. So you were supposed to laugh then. When I raise my hand, that will be an indication that you should laugh. And I can guess why. Richard raised it, but I can guess why there are so many people in the room today. My guess is that most of you don't care about North Korea, but you will do anything to avoid discussion of the election. And this represents an opportunity, a safe space, if you will, for the next hour and a half. We don't have to talk about it. And listen, I feel your pain. I'm with you. But nevertheless, the time has come to talk about the topic at hand. So we start with a puzzle. You know, it seems like it's every 6 months, every year, there's a new UN Security Council resolution that's passed. It's the strongest resolution, sanctions resolution ever passed in the history of North Korea sanctions. Each time and every time, it's the strongest ever. And yet, what we have found is the DPRK's missile tests have increased, and nuclear tests have increased in number, in variety, in sophistication. They've moved from liquid fuel rockets to solid fuel rockets. They're testing engines. You know, they have failures. All missile and nuclear programs have failures. But they obviously are advancing in the face of what are the strongest sanctions in the history of DPRK sanctions activity by the UN. So how does one explain this? That is where we start. And what we do in our study, is we look at three questions. Do sanctions against North Korea work? I think you can probably guess the answer to that one. And if not, why not? What's going on here? Because you can't solve a problem unless you know what the problems are. And number two, what, if any, unintended consequences, positive or negative, do sanctions against North Korea have? This is not a gotcha game when we talk about unintended consequences. Sometimes in this, in the Beltway, one way to sort of go after a policy is to say, aha, there's an unintended consequence. You wanted to do this good thing, but this bad thing is happening. That's not what we're doing here. We expect that in all policies, there are unintended consequences, positive unintended consequences and negative unintended consequences. And some of them matter and some of them don't. But what we try to do is map what these are so that we can sort of make a better assessment of what we're doing. And then finally, we ask the question, what can be done to improve the effectiveness of sanctions? And we think modestly that we have some new thinking on that, but we would love your feedback and counsel. So by way of background, sanctions, as Richard said, they are an increasingly important central piece of U.S. foreign policy making, whether it's Russia or Iran or North Korea or, virtually any entity. For reasons of blood diamonds to human rights, sanctions have become the answer to a problem. But what we do in the report is look at sanctions. We look at the general sanctions literature. What does social science have to say about sanctions? Do they work? Do they not work? Then we look at the question of do sanctions on North Korea in particular, what is the track record there? And what we find is that there are some things missing here, or there are some habits that have proven hard to die. So one of the habits, methodologically speaking, is we always focus on sanctions from the perspective of the country imposing sanctions, from the sender of sanctions when they send them to a target. We always look at it sort of from our perspective. And what we decided to do was sort of look at it from the recipient or the target's perspective. Well, how does North Korea see these sanctions? And that's why we interviewed defectors who used to work for state trading companies, because, again, it was their job to beat these. And we want to know how they think about the problem. In fact, what we look at this as is less of I'm a national security guy. I'm at the MIT Security Studies program. My inclination is to look at things with a national security lens. But we broke with that at John's wise urging and looked at this more as a business case study and then put on our national security glasses at the end. But initially what we're doing is looking at this as a business, North Korea Inc., and we're attempting to document their practices. How do they get insurance, get financing, close the deal, write contracts? Their partners, who are they working with? They're not working alone. And the pathways. How does something get from point A to point B? And we felt that by doing that, we would have a much better understanding of why we're having problems. Before I turn it over to John, I think it's worthwhile to remind ourselves that sanctions are a complex instrument used for many different purposes. And often we have conversations that sort of conflate the purposes and are unclear about what we're trying to achieve. So I want to be crystal clear about what we mean when we're talking about North Korea sanctions. So let us remind ourselves first that sanctions can have many different goals. One can be denial, that is to say, sanctions imposed to prevent, to interdict a country so that it cannot acquire weapons of mass destruction, technologies, and materials. Another, you can use sanctions for coercion, to inflict pain, to get an adversary to change their behavior. You can impose sanctions for bargaining. We saw a lot of this during the Iran negotiations, or the run-up to the Iran negotiations, where you put on sanctions so you have chips to bargain, something to take away if the other side makes concessions. There's also sanctions just sort of normatively for punishment. I've talked to colleagues in South Korea and Japan who just feel that North Korea has done a lot of terrible things, human rights and all the rest, and they need to be punished. And then finally, there are those who would argue we should impose sanctions to induce regime collapse or regime change. This study is narrowly focused. It is focused solely on sanctions for the purpose of denying weapons, technology, and materials to North Korea. We do not really go into these other areas of coercion or regime change. We're looking at the problem, how do we keep the North Korean weapons programs from advancing beyond where they are now? How do we stop that, retard that, prevent that, and then hopefully get to a point of freeze and rollback? So when we talk about sanctions, that's the narrow parameters in which we are exploring these questions. Let me pause here, turn it over to my more handsome colleague, who will describe to you some of the things that we found.
Thank you all. Echoing what Jim mentioned, my thanks to Richard and Jonathan for having us today, and a special thanks to Jim. Jim used to be my boss, and so to work with your boss is a very special thing. For some, it's usually a deal breaker, but I've benefited enormously from the collaboration here on this project that goes many years back, so a special note of thanks to Jim. This is our last briefing, so many sets is the completion of our project. As Jim laid out the background and the foundations to our overall endeavor here, I wanted to emphasize again the case study approach followed by the analysis of the security implications. And here, if you look at it, what we've really tried to do is map out the commercial ecosystem within which the North Korean entities did their business inside of China. Now, in terms of the key findings, on a standalone basis, none of these are really earth-shattering, but I present it to you as a picture. First and foremost, the really big story here is the innovation in terms of North Korean state trading companies' activities inside of the Chinese market via the greater use of more capable Chinese middlemen. These middlemen are, for every extent and purposes, the type of middlemen that you would partner up with if you're doing business in China. So the story is one of normalcy. This is the story of globalization. This is the story of the Chinese national economy growing to a level where foreign companies set up manufacturing plants inside of China to prepare for this growing national economy and this national market inside of China. And with that, the greater opportunities for the North Korean entities to go out and procure are something that is, in itself, the scale of it is quite impressive. So as we look at this phenomenon, when we play out the notion of the cycle of the greater application of sanctions on North Korean entities, what happens in the marketplace is that this elevates risk. And with that elevated risk, private Chinese companies are now saying, it's not so much we won't do business with you, this is too risky. Rather, for the elevated risk, you will have to compensate for us the acceptance of this risk, and that translates into higher commission fees. And as the North Korean entities pay out higher commission fees, you see a market mechanism where more capable private Chinese come out of the woodwork to do this procurement. So with this, we're seeing the outsourcing of logistics by the private Chinese company to other Chinese companies, financing other elements of doing a transaction on behalf of a North Korean client. It's much more sophisticated in the past. And with this, we're seeing a phenomena almost along the lines of financing of business deals. What this means is that you see the bulk payment of a particular transaction by the North Korean partner at the end of a transaction. What this means is that the cash on delivery at the end lowers the risk of detection. You don't see the movement of finances or cash at the beginning parts of transactions, another part of hiding in the open of the phenomenon that takes place inside of the market. The second aspect is that we're seeing North Korean players, and really, if you look at it, there aren't that many of these type of individuals, embedding themselves in China. The significance of that is that as these North Korean commercial officials reside in China, they get to learn the marketplace much better. So the development of this tacit knowledge translates into more effective transactions, increased sophistication in selecting and working with Chinese middlemen, and ultimately the ability to use a lot of the infrastructure that already resides in China, the Chinese financial system, the Chinese transportation infrastructure, other aspects of energy as it goes closer to the border and so forth. The third finding is in relation to Southeast Asia, in particular Singapore and Hong Kong. North Korean entities have used these jurisdictions in the past, but what's different is if you look at the global hub of the port in Hong Kong, the sheer volume of traffic that goes through that particular port gives you a sense of how hiding in the open is very effective, and using these type of middlemen to do these transactions on behalf of North Korean clients becomes a force multiplier. In the case of Singapore, we're seeing the drawdown of Switzerland as the money management capital of the world. A lot of it has to do with U.S. Governmental efforts to crack down on these numbered accounts that were a big part of illicit finance and other illicit activities happening in the international community. A lot of that activity has migrated to Singapore now, such that Singapore isn't the capital of Asia-Pacific for money management, but the capital in terms of the international community. So with that, the ability to do the illicit financial transactions as well through a place like Singapore, we're seeing more of that as well. Now, tying this all together, in particular, what enables these North Korean entities to reside in China for so long In many cases, they are dual-hatted as diplomats, and presenting diplomatic credentials, they're able to reside in these markets for years on end. And recall the accumulation of this tacit knowledge that enables them to do their business transactions more effectively, a very important force multiplier there as well. But the key takeaway here is that it's, again, a very small universe. We're looking at a small number of North Korean entities that are doing these type of transactions. Our colleagues at C4ADS, the Center for Advanced Defense Studies, recently issued a report in partnership with the Asan Institute called In China's Shadow, and they mapped out North Korean overseas networks. And their notion of looking at the commercially available data and crunching that, using it as a large data type of project, and what they produced was this idea that really it's a small number of North Korean interlocutors, and then based on that, doing one degree of separation analysis, you can map out some of the Chinese interlocutors and players there. So you get a sense of the business case study approach as well as the use of technology, and piecing that together, there's, I think, greater opportunity to map out this commercial ecosystem. Now, here I wanted to take a step back and provide the broader context. One of the big benefits for North Korea is luck. They happen to be neighbors with the largest growing economy. Even with their setbacks, the Chinese national economy and what has to offer is quite striking in terms of North Korean capabilities. Here present the red line inter-Korean trade and the top line, the blue line, the China-North Korea trade. Now, inter-Korean trade has been relatively flat, but I think the key takeaway here is really looking at the China-North Korea trade spiking in the late 2000s. Now, in a lot of the analysis, the focus has been what's been happening inside of North Korea. How's the North Korean economy changed? Are there signs of revitalization, reform, and whatnot? But very little of the analysis has shifted to what North Korea incorporated, these elites, are doing inside of China. And if you look at that picture, the notion of what's causing the spike, I think, is a very, very important part of the puzzle. And from our estimation, Premier Wen Jiabao's visit in October 2009 is something that really has to be taken into full consideration here. This trip was significant because if you look at it, it set out a party-to-party work plan in terms of building out and stabilizing the institution of the Workers' Party of Korea with direct benefits for the procurement efforts as an unintended consequence. This is clearly something that the Chinese authorities didn't want to happen, but in the broader economic and commercial interactions that happened, you're seeing within that channel a small percentage being used for the illicit activities. So here, the main photo from that time period, in Western media, we only saw Kim Jong-il, who's sitting in the middle, and to his right, Premier Wen Jiabao, and to his left, then-Foreign Minister Yang Jiechi. The other people weren't included, in many cases because no one knew who they were. And to give you a quick background in terms of these individuals, you had the chairman of the National Development and Reform Commission, Chinese Commerce Minister, the senior party chiefs of all the local Chinese provinces bordering North Korea, and senior military. So you essentially have the equivalent of the highest level delegation China has sent abroad, concluding a number of agreements. Western media tended to use a lot of this particular photo of the Communist Youth League, the scarf, and this notion that here was a revitalization of an alliance. But if anything, this was the beginning of deeper commercial interactions. The three announcements that came out, economic development, tourism, and education agreements being essentially the big landmark achievements, were dismissed as pure propaganda. But in many respects, they created the legal infrastructure that the Chinese leadership signaled to their domestic constituency, saying that it's okay, it's legal to do business with North Korean entities. It's not illegal. And with that, we see the uptick of the commercial activities. Now, when you zero in on the geography of this, North Hamgyong province in the second map here in the top right-hand corner is where the mineral resources are in North Korea. We're talking about the coal, the iron ore, and some rare earth elements. When it came to the peak commodity price for coal, North Korean mines were coming online as the peak prices were occurring. So if you think of the money that was made through this type of interaction, the North Korean regime was able to amass considerable residual funds from this particular trade that resides inside of China. And as that became the basis to finance some of the procurement activities, you're seeing a pipeline. And again, the caveat here is the commercial channels between North Korea and China, the vast majority of it is benign trade. But once you build out that channel, we would argue that that constitutes a dual-use technology. Then you can use that channel for the procurement of some of the high-end materials and technologies for the WMD programs. So at this point, I'll turn this over to Jim to look at the positive and negative unintended consequences.
Thank you, John. Let me underline what John has said. I think it's really, really important. The story he is telling is a story from 2009 on of evolution and innovation. It's not, you know, this is not your father's North Korea. In the old days, North Korean state trading company managers focused on the border region, might take a day trip across into China, come back. A lot of the goods were delivered by rusty North Korean or Russian freighters hugging the coast coming from the Middle East or elsewhere. That's all gone, almost all gone. And the story that John tells is a story where it's not day trips across the border. Chinese state trading companies are taking their families, those officials are taking their families and embedding in the Chinese heartland. And their kids are going to school, and they're treated just like an expat business person, like any other expat business person. And so this is a story of innovation, and it's good to be reminded, and we'll get to this in a moment, that sanctions are an iterative game, right? The enemy gets a vote. We may take action X, but they're going to respond. They're going to try to get around whatever you come up with. And we have a tendency to sort of repeat the same thing over and over again, whereas they're innovating in the face of what we do and getting around it. Measure, countermeasure, back and forth. So if we're going to have some success here, we need to innovate as well and to think about it differently than we do today. But as I said, the purpose of this project was in part to document practices, pathways, and partners, and also to look at the issue of unintended consequences. And we generated a list of different potential negative, positive, negative and positive unintended consequences, and ones we just didn't know how to code them. So among the negative ones, and John already alluded to this, this is sort of the headline for a lot of folks. We imposed sanctions successfully. That meant we raised the cost of doing business, right? That was our goal. Let's raise the cost of doing business. And what happened was the North Koreans monetized that risk, paid higher commission fees that drew more capable firms, and in the net resulted in more sophisticated procurement. They paid more money. They got better partners. Their better partners produced for them. So that was a negative unintended consequence. Other possibilities are incentivizing collaboration with bad actors. You know, my enemy's enemy is my friend. That it might hinder positive forms of engagement. There have been questions whether some of the OFAC rules that Treasury has will inhibit the ability to have track twos. I don't think that's really happened so far, but we wanted to look at that as a possibility. Whether by trying to go after Chairman Kim, we would end up taking actions that would hurt the civilian population who are already in a state of fragility, those elites who don't live in Pyongyang, that maybe we could trigger a North Korean collapse. You know, we say as policymakers, well, we'll turn the dial two notches. We'll get two notches worth of pressure. But how confident are we're going to get two notches worth of pressure and not four, or four and not six? You know, I have doubts about our ability to do this with precision. I'm guessing there's a lot of interaction effects that we can't predict. So we have a concern that by taking certain actions, we might actually trigger a collapse that people don't want to have. And there's an unintended consequence, theoretically, a theoretical possibility, that sanctions overreach backfires. And you've heard Secretary Liu discuss this in an op-ed. The idea is if we keep going to sanctions over and over again, this creates incentives for other countries and other governments to come up with banking systems or ways of doing business so that we don't have them by the collar. And that we will stimulate this. Now, we looked at all of these, and I would say the ones in red are the ones that we're most concerned about most. That is to say, I think definitely the documentation shows we had the unintended consequence of actually strengthening North Korean procurement, because when we imposed costs, they raised their fees, and the fees drew bigger, more capable fish. And so we need to factor that in when we design sanctions. The other one is we're not prepared to say yet that sanctions have hurt the economy for average North Koreans, but certainly some of the proposals being discussed, whether it's remittances or other sorts of things, there are concerns there. Some humanitarian groups have had more difficulty with some of the national laws in South Korea, being able to operate in South Korea. These are firms doing health work or work in nutrition. So we're not prepared as a study to say this has kicked in, but we're prepared to say that we need to keep an eye out for this. Let's talk for a minute about sanctions and positive unintended consequences. Again, these come in all varieties. We looked at the extent to which these sanctions may have generated a market for compliance among larger financial firms in China. Also, the possibility that, you know, when the North Koreans send out all these people and they go and they live in China, you know, these people get to see what the outside world is like, and they get to compare what their home is to the outside world, and maybe that's not such a bad thing. But of the two, I think we definitely found that the first was the most prominent. Not as widespread, but significant. That is to say, among larger financial firms in China, these are the firms that want to do business in New York, they want to do business in Geneva and Zurich, that imposing sanctions created a market for compliance. The CEOs getting on the phone and saying, we need a compliance department. We need to hire compliance officers. If you have children in their 20s, tell them to go into compliance, because that's where the money is, my friends. They are hiring. There is a whole cottage industry, including trade publications and all the rest, legal firms that have all built up in China and elsewhere on the part of firms that don't want to get their hands dirty inadvertently, and then therefore forfeit the opportunities for doing business internationally. So that's a positive thing, and we think that ought to be encouraged. And then finally on the, you know, the ones we just don't know how to code them, there are two here. The notion that sanctions would introduce North Korean elites to markets. Well, on the one hand, that's good, right? So let's say there is a transition in North Korea at some point. It would be great to have some technocrats who really knew how markets worked and could go back and help with an economic transition back in the DPRK. The downside, of course, is while they're doing this, they're improving their skills and helping with the WMD program. So, it's, you know, it cuts both ways, at least short-term, long-term. And then the other one is sanctions are famous for fostering corruption. Now, admittedly, with North Korea, you're already starting at a pretty high level here, right? So you're only talking about fostering corruption beyond at the margins. But the intellectual question for us is, so you get more corruption because of sanctions in North Korea. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? You know, I could see a case being made either way. But in any case, neither of these seems, these ones that we don't know quite what to do with, seem to be as prominent as the other unintended consequences. So let me pause here, and John's going to come up and talk about some of our first set of recommendations.
We hope this is keeping folks away, not too distracting us during this revolving door here. But the recommendations related to improving the effectiveness based on a round of briefings that we did in the region in Seoul, Beijing, and Tokyo. And we had an earlier draft of the report that became the basis of harvesting these type of reactions on some of these early ideas. And when we were preparing for the Beijing trip, we were bracing ourselves to, in some instances, be either laughed out of a room or told very in strong words to leave, because we swung for the fences. And for the engaging China via these national interests, clearly the Chinese are alarmed in terms of what's happening with the WMD programs on the Korean Peninsula. But the reactions are slightly different. I'll go back to how the divergence there centers around some of the THAAD-related announcements. But we pitched this idea of utilizing Chinese domestic laws to look at disrupting North Korean state trading company embedded in China, their relationship with private Chinese company middlemen upstream. By upstream, we mean before the deal had been done. Because once a deal is done and once the procurement channels are triggered and you see the private Chinese company using their other Chinese company interlocutors, logistically, that item is more or less considered to already be in North Korea. So with this idea of disrupting upstream, the way we heard it is that the Chinese government would not seal the border with North Korea. They would not end their trade with North Korea. But certainly they were interested in measures that sounded like, in the phrase that we coined, was sanitize their trade with North Korea. This idea that the bulk of their trade with North Korea were the very things that they encouraged the North Koreans to do, shore up stability of the regime in the country. But that small percentage, as I mentioned before, this dual-use technology consideration of the commercial channels, ways to sanitize the trade, the anti-corruption campaign being one candidate. Now, we're cognizant that this is a direct tool used by the ruling leadership in their consolidation efforts, but for our purposes, this is an organization that is already in place, that could be directed to the corrupt party officials at the local levels to disrupt these partnerships. Coincidence correlation, soon after briefing, and this was after the release of the C40ADS report as well, this is where we read through our Google filter the headline that the Chinese authorities had detained the CEO of Tandong Hongxiang Industrial Group, and she was charged with engaging in criminal activities with North Korean entities. But in Chinese media, it was played out as someone who was a corrupt party official who had engaged in commercial activities. Western media depiction was, here's someone who violated sanctions and she was caught. But irrespective of the way that it was framed, the notion that the Chinese authorities were using their domestic laws to break up these type of partnerships was very reassuring. The second key thing, the significance of something like that, is as much as the October 2009 agreements were a signal from the Chinese leadership to their domestic constituency that it's okay to do business with North Korean entities, this particular measure had the effect of saying that it's illegal to engage in these type of criminal activities where it deals with procurement of items that can go into North Korean WMD programs. There are some data points, though. If you look closely, in 2013, a group of about six Chinese ministries issued what's called Technical Bulletin 59, 236-page report of very dense technical information. And on the title, it basically said Chinese nationals are prohibited from selling these items to North Koreans. But we know that effort failed, because after 2013, North Korean ballistic missile testing and nuclear testing increased at a larger and more effective scale. But this idea that the Chinese authorities used this case in a high-profile manner, and it did resonate in the sense of, here's someone who was caught and who was being punished and being tried and punished for the criminal activities here, we thought were very encouraging movements. On the capacity building front, I think it's important to recognize the important work that's being done by the UN panel of experts. As an investigation, ongoing investigation, and a body that gathers this type of evidence, there's a great deal of facts and figures and exhibits in terms of manifests that have been forged and other pieces that I think are very important in this broader effort to do this evidence-based analysis of North Korean procurement activities. As respect to what we mentioned about embedding, this notion of very carefully monitoring North Korean embassies where there is this misuse of diplomatic privileges is another important element of disrupting this type of partnership between North Korean state trading company and local player. Once you remove the North Korean element, it takes a while for the replacement to come in and learn about the market again. So you're essentially buying time with those type of measures. It was an encouraging piece of development earlier last spring. We saw the government of Vietnam expel two North Korean diplomats engaged in illicit illegal criminal transactions that are geared towards some of the weapons and other illicit activities. But those type of precedents, I think, are important and something that can be certainly expanded upon. So here, let me turn back to Jim to look at the compliance culture components.
Thank you, John. This is the last couple of slides, and then we'll go on to question and answer. Again, we have had this set of recommendations. Encourage work with China. The U.S. should work with China so that it can use its domestic laws to go after North Korea, Inc., whether it's anti-corruption laws, anti-counterfeiting laws, anti-drug laws. John talked about capacity building, building the capacity of national governments to be able to track trade, building the capacity of our local embassies to match and compete with the DPRK's embassies in countries so that we can try to disrupt what they're doing. Maybe that means outreach to the Korean business speaking community, business community in some of these countries. And then we have a couple of other categories here. One, building on that positive unintended consequence that we observe, we say take some steps that would further encourage this culture of compliance. Remember, the more firms that are affirmatively trying to stay away from North Korea, that shrinks the pool, allows you to focus on the ones who are happy to engage in illicit activity. So we want to see the prosecution of some high-profile cases, something that ends up on the front page of the local newspaper in Malaysia, in Singapore, so CEOs pick up the phone and say, "What are we vulnerable to this? What can we do to make sure we don't get ensnared?" And to experiment with the use of incentives. You know, one thing that John has really taught me in all this is thinking about this as a business problem, as a market problem, less of a national security thing. We should be, you know, we have a lot of money. China has a lot of money. The DPRK, they don't have so much. If we are in a business market environment, we should be using our comparative advantage, cash, to undermine the operations of North Korea, Inc. We should be giving money to those who provide intelligence, who defect, who want to rat out one of their, competitors who happens to be a Chinese middleman. There are lots of ways in a market environment. No one's doing this because they have a strong commitment to ideological values. All these players are in it for the cash. So we should be able to use cash to our advantage. And that means not simply punishing, but rewarding. And then we have a set of recommendations we would make that go directly after North Korea, Inc., in an attempt to sort of get around this problem of, well, we impose costs, so they raise fees, so bigger fish join them. If we can disrupt them directly, then we avoid that bad unintended consequence. And those recommendations focus on shrinking the scope, the size, and the tenure of the operations of state trading companies. As John alluded to, if they have to re-up every year or they're sent home and have to come back 2 years later, all that disruption matters. And then finally, and this is the last slide, because we're academics, of course we have to have a set of recommendations about information collection and analysis, how we think about the problem, what is the information that we don't have that we would want to have to try to solve this problem. And not surprisingly, we say we should look at this as a business case study. And I'm happy to say the U.S. government has been very responsive to these recommendations. We should have game simulations, but the players shouldn't be policymakers. They, or some of them should be, maybe some Treasury folks and some customs officials. But they should be mainly business people from the region. And they're set up in a simulation where the job of one country or one team is to import something, and the job of the other team is to block it, and to try to learn from that interactive way of approaching the problem. We say we should use these state trading company managers who have defected, we should use them as a red team. We should go back to them and say, well, if we did this, how would you get around it? And they might have some interesting things to say about how we might be able to improve sanctions. We also want to think differently about and have different models of analysis. John has used the phrase several times now about the commercial ecosystem. It's not North Korea by itself. It's North Korea in East Asia, where there are a lot of big forces at work, globalization and trade. We need to understand and think about it as an ecosystem problem. We need to address this. This is not your father's proliferator. In the old days, the simple days, a proliferator would have a dedicated program that would be siloed off from everything. This is a situation in which procurement is mixed, where there's legitimate goods being procured that are mixed with illegitimate goods. You need to think about it differently. I'll just skip to the number 11 and say, last, we are pleading for an evidence-based outcomes-focused evaluation. Right now, our standard of success when it comes to North Korea's sanctions is whether we passed a sanctions bill. If we pass a sanctions bill, then that's, a resolution, then that's a success. That's like judging a medicine by the number of prescriptions that are written, rather than actually testing the effectiveness of the drug. We need to get real about whether we are being effective and why we're not being effective and where, in some cases, we're actually making the problem worse. So we've found a lot of interest in this on the part of the U.S. government and other governments, and we're encouraged by the response that at least some of these things are going to be acted on. Let me stop here and say, again, underline our thanks for being here at this wonderful institution, and that we look forward to, again, having a dialogue now, learning from you, your criticisms and your suggestions, because we plan to continue this, continue cohorts of interviews, and continue to try to work this problem. So we look forward to hearing what you have to say. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for all of you for coming here today. When we planned this event, we did it with a clear design in mind. We knew this would be the day before the U.S. election, and we thought we all needed a distraction from following other trends. This piece of research, and as well the recent study published by Asan and the C4ADS, which is a new one for me. Research organizations kind of sprout and come out of nowhere. But to be serious, they have, in combination, appreciably enhanced our understanding, but still very, very imperfect understanding, of the phenomena under review. North Korea is a unique kind of problem analytically from the point of view of available data and the like. And yet, in an ironic way, by looking at the critical role of North Korean activities in China in various ways, and now increasingly in other locations, we can acquire, I think, as Richard noted before, a more granular understanding of the phenomena under review. It's a provocative paper, and one that the author should be congratulated about. And yet, at the same time, it raises, in my mind at least, a number of other questions, beginning with a very fundamental one. We know that North Korea has lived by its wits for a very, very long time in various contexts. I like to observe that, you know, for all of those who anticipate the end of North Korea, when I wake up in the morning and I turn my computer on, they're still there. And that ought to sober us, chasten us to an extent about assumptions that we make. And yet, even on the phenomenon of North Korea Incorporated, it's a clever title, but it would seem to me that what we know about the behavior of the North is that if you have sanctions somewhere within the system to engage in commercial behavior, whether this is all highly coordinated as distinct from different entities within the system that may be pursuing this on the one hand to curry favor with those above them within the system, but at the same time for gains of their own. That's something that I think warrants some clarification. I would note also, and this isn't to fault them, but if I'm correct, the interviews with the State Trading Corporation personnel, it's a small number, to be sure. We're assuming, of course, their credibility and so forth. They date from 2014, if I'm right. We're talking here about a moving target, something that is evolving all the time. Whether or not, what conclusions or inferences might you draw on what is observable over now what is a significant period of time since you conducted the interviews. Let me also flag, if I could, I noticed in your one of your charts, your data on trade between North Korea and China stopped in 2011. If you were to extend that out for another 3-4 years, would we see something? I think I know the answer, but I'm going to let you guys give us the answer. That there's been a plateauing on the trade, which could reflect any number of phenomena, but might at the same time highlight some of the inherent constraints that North Korea may face over time. You've alluded to the fact that the monetization of this activity means a much higher premium has to be paid to various Chinese interlocutors. That may be true, but are there upper bounds beyond which they cannot go? I will acknowledge that one of the true puzzles about North Korea today is that there clearly is the generation of significant wealth there, at least within Pyongyang. How much it extends beyond Pyongyang, we can discuss. But part of me still wants to know, where is that money coming from? Is there any way we can connect those dots? Because what this study demonstrates, and I say that it's kind of like it opens up our understanding here, and of course the ASEAN study as well does this in a very, very detailed way using metadata and the like, is again how little we really understand about how North Koreans operate in this larger hostile world that they confront. So I'm in no way trying to dissuade you from doing more. It is only to highlight how much we really require added insight. A couple of other points, and then I'll stop. One, obviously, it relates to China. Even though you're analyzing essentially North Korean behavior within an ecosystem, international and China specific. But, you know, when we look at China, that too is a moving target in terms of attitudes towards North Korea. John, I'd have to quibble with one insight. I remember writing about this at the time when Wang Jiabao traveled to North Korea in 2009. That struck me at the time as a very big deal because of the composition of the delegation, kind of a normalization, if you would. What's the context of that? It was the year after Kim Jong-il had a serious stroke. In retrospect, I think that the Chinese were making an investment. You could argue that it was a way or a foot in the door, they thought, into the North Korean system, that on the presumption that Kim's days were numbered, and they were. The very fact that it has not worked out according to plan, or rather that the interlocutors that the Chinese had in those earlier years, particularly, of course, Jiang Song-taek, is no longer with us for reasons that we all know. So it raises the whole question, as the Chinese estimate the risks, the opportunities, the degrees of investment, political, economic, and otherwise, could we imagine under some circumstances reassessments in Beijing, even if for, if you will, for official media statements and the like, that may be somewhat obscured. If I might quote Sarah Palin, how's that hopey-changey thing working out for you now? And that's where there's a lot of sobriety in China. And, you know, but what your study can do, and I think that the ASEAN study did in a very, very significant way, is to offer exposure to China, not so much to shame China, but to maybe even at some level educate the Chinese themselves. I mean, there's a presumption if Liaoning Hongxiang has this big building in Dandong that obviously everyone in Beijing in the Politburo must know about all this activity. I'm not so sure about all of that. There really is a sense of how do we mix and match and model all these disparate activities that we see in this most extraordinary of systems, and I don't mean that as a compliment. I think I'll stop there rather than take more time. But again, my congratulations to all of you on a very creative piece of research from which I really, really benefited a lot.
Jim and John, do you want to respond to anything that Jonathan said before we take questions?
I do. I want to endorse it all, or most all of it. I won't cover everything you said.
One other thing I forgot to mention, looking at my notes here, see this, and that is in policy terms, you are advocating a level of involvement, quantitative and qualitative, on this issue that vastly exceeds anything that the United States government has done to this point. That is not to discourage that, but it is only to highlight what would really be required for many of the embedded recommendations you have in your study. Can we practice what we preach? Because if we argue that this is this extraordinary danger to the nonproliferation system, nonproliferation regime, to regional security, maybe to global security, there's the sense in which the words don't match the level of conduct. So how would you recommend, as we go into a new administration, that they pursue it?
So let me say, I took good notes here, which will prove helpful to me later, but on a couple of general themes. Jonathan, I think, rightly says, and it's certainly a underlying principle of our findings, that this is a dynamic situation. You know, he asks us, you know, have we conducted more interviews past 2014? I think the answer there is we're hoping to do. This was a snapshot, and in an ideal world, we would have a time series that we would be able to compare over time. But the point, the core point is the important one. From 2009 on and from probably 2014 on, this is a dynamic situation that changes. And we have to, our fundamental recommendation is we have to stop doing the same thing over and over again and actually respond to what the adversary is doing. And I would point out that the nature of this iterative game gives us certain opportunities. Now, so when North Korea does things to evade sanctions, they too, their policies carry unintended positive and negative consequences. And by that, I mean, in part, it creates new vulnerabilities. So if you've parked all your cash in provincial banks in China because you're trying to get around financing laws or whatever, you know, BDA-type problems, well, that creates a vulnerability. So we need to be watching what they do, because some of the actions they take to get around what we are doing will create new opportunities. And so I want to underscore absolutely that it's dynamic. It's a great question to ask whether the state trading companies are highly coordinated or are they off. You know, for a long time, everyone, you know, every boat on its bottom or whatever that phrase is, where everyone had to produce cash, you know, had to contribute their own cash to the system. I think that's an excellent question. My sense of it, and this is only based on very little data in the press, is that there seems to have been an attempt to rein this in, rein in the people on the border who were doing, who were private citizens doing procurement for themselves, as it were.
By the North Koreans?
Yes, by the government. Now, I've only seen a couple of reports to that effect. I wouldn't put too much emphasis on it, but I agree with the core finding that it's a dynamic thing and you have to chart it over time. You just can't check a box and do the same thing over and over again. And I agree, we understand very little, and we understand a lot more than we used to. There is a lot more information on North Korea than there was even a decade ago, but it's still the most opaque country in the world. We know more about every other country in the world than we do about North Korea, so there's lots of research to keep us employed at least through retirement. Can I imagine reassessments in Beijing? You know, I think of, and I'm not a China specialist, and I would defer to those of you who are, I'm reminded that China invented bureaucracy and that it's a big place with lots of interests at the provincial level, the national level, and elsewhere. So my guess is that different parts of the Chinese government feel differently about North Korea. Some are much more sympathetic. Some are less sympathetic. Some have a vision for China where they see North Korea as a problem, an obstacle, something undermining where they want to be. Others look through it to a prism of, you know, loyalty or a history or organizational interest. So I think there will be contestation, and who will win, I don't know. But I can tell you it's going to be hard. I can tell you that every time we do something, this is not your North, I live in Massachusetts, so I can say this out loud here. You know, when we do something like THAAD, where we're, quote, sharpening the choices for China, all that does is give the, it confirms for those in the bureaucracy who are suspicious of the U.S. that we are all about encirclement and containment. And it then it, they can take, when we do something like THAAD, and there's someone else in the room that says, well, we should really work with the U.S. and try to sanitize this trade and use domestic laws to break up North Korea, Inc., they suddenly are in a much weaker position politically because we've done something that has helped their opponents. So they may reassess, but that reassessment, the result of that reassessment will depend in part on what we do and whether we create advocates or adversaries in that decision-making process. Let's see. I think you're right about the value of this in part can be not necessarily for shaming, but helping create greater awareness of what's happening in this big country we call China. I think you're absolutely right about that. And on level of involvement, I would say Jonathan is absolutely right. You know, we advocate doing things that would require more work than really has ever been done. But I would say, and to especially the young people out there, timing is everything. And we, the one positive thing I can say about Chairman Kim is he has been very good for this report. You know, his tests, you know, I talked about sanctions create a market for compliance. All these tests have created a market for new ideas on North Korea, and I think we wouldn't have gotten in half the doors to see half the officials that we've seen if it wasn't for the fact that these tests have created a demand for new thinking.
So if I could just add to what Jim mentioned, and thank you very much, Jonathan. One part that I specifically want to respond to, and it's a very important observation, it's unprecedented, the type of cooperation that we're espousing. But the three encouraging things, I would frame it as a three antis, so anti-corruption, anti-narcotics, and anti-money laundering. Counterfeiting, I should say. So to Jim's earlier point about looking at our national interests and viewing it from that perspective, there is an alignment. There's a precedent in terms of U.S.-China cooperation on the anti-narcotics front. In the early 2000s, as we saw the flow of opiates coming in from Afghanistan, there was U.S.-China cooperation on that, very discreet and, from my understanding, you know, pretty effective. Now, the open secret is that there's a narcotics problem on the China-North Korea border. So the North Korean pharmaceutical industry, if you have it, they're pumping in something called ICE, which is a low-cost and apparently very effective form of meth that is going into parts of China as well. We know that this is a problem because there's a parallel detention system. One is for those who are labeled as North Korean migrant workers who are caught, detained, and then sent back to North Korea, and then a separate parallel detention center for anyone engaged in this narcotics activity. To the part about counterfeiting, when Jim and I were in Beijing, the point came up. The Chinese authorities were detecting more of counterfeit Chinese currency. So you have a North Korean, top of the class expertise, the super notes, the counterfeiting of U.S. $100 bills, the transferability appears of the skill set to the Chinese currency. So you have these national interests that overlap that are the building blocks, and it really is up to policymakers how you align them. So, with that notion of looking at this ongoing problem, North Korea's WMD program, the goal in our particular focus on denial strategies, the Chinese and American authorities are in complete agreement. It's the means and the focus on sanctions that have created this type of backlash. And the final point I mentioned, this will probably come up in the Q&A, the indications of the Iran playbook now being applied to North Korea, it seems like there's a doubling down on that approach that would, in many cases, minimize and, I think, unfortunately, push aside some of these early opportunities.
Thanks to all of you. And we'll now go to Q&A. We have about a half an hour. Once I call on you, please wait for the mic. Identify yourself and the person to whom your question is posed. I saw Stanley Roth first. He's in the middle of the room right there.
Hi, Stanley Roth, no affiliation. I have a comment and a question. The comment is I found the remarks about that kind of outrageous. The notion that China, which for decades has given priority to the survival of the regime over any other consideration, is going to be overly influenced by that. To me, this is a talking point, not a serious argument for the deployment of a defensive system, and I think it's an overly bureaucratic analysis to say, gee, it weakens the friends or the people who want to be more forthcoming. We're playing their game. The question, I thought the reported study, which I haven't read, but just listening to it, is absolutely fascinating for proposing some alternatives, and I totally endorse not doing the same thing again. But I ask particularly if in the interviews of defectors there was any insight on the threshold question, because before you do this tremendous amount of work to impose better sanctions, did defectors have any view of whether sanctions mattered, that even if they were done the way you described, that it would influence a regime which cares not for its own people but only for the party and some in the military? Or could we do everything right and still be no better off in terms of changing North Korean policy?
Sure. So to your point, thank you very much, Stanley, for the question. With respect to the defectors, it's always problematic interviewing defectors, particularly as it relates to political aspects of the regime. One of the benefits for us was that if you've done business, you can tell. And our questions were very technical in terms of a different type of PRC, profit equals revenue minus cost. So drilling in on revenue generation, on cost management, fixed, variable costs, things along those lines, different types of contracts. Once you get into those weeds, it becomes pretty clear if someone's done business before or not. And with that, as we zeroed in on their commercial activities, to your point about threshold, what we discovered in some instances, it did initially create that setback. It was difficult for them to do the type of business. But the way that they described it was that the previous way of doing it was somewhat inefficient. It wasn't prioritized. It was a fight for resources. But as they became affected by the sanctions, it was almost this notion where they were forced to figure out a better way of doing it. And that's the part that in the secondary and tertiary effects of the application of sanctions, This is, I think, an area that really has to be brought to the attention, particularly to the group that wants to apply the Iran playbook to the North Korean actors here. So the threshold question is translated for them in terms of elevated risks, and then how they're, and this is where the market mechanism kicks in, where the Chinese middlemen are the ones who kind of solve that problem for them by saying, we want more commission fee, and the item that we're about to procure for you has suddenly gone up in price.
And so with that kind of mechanism, you're seeing more efficient and effective procurement patterns. But that actually shifts into the open space. They're doing a lot of this type of action in the open, where we're not going to see these, as Jim was mentioning, these freighters bringing these components back to North Korea. A lot of it is done through the quite large volume of trade happening between the two countries.
And let me take both of these excellent questions and comments. On the threshold question, I also understand it to mean, one question is, did it matter before? And I think the answer is it did matter. That's why we saw this sort of paradox where you get the higher commission fees. But then I also took it, the question to mean, well, if we did everything we recommended, would it matter? And, you know, and I don't know the answer to that question. I think the recommendations we have about the way of thinking about the problem would have an impact, because we're saying, I think we know that the way we have been doing it is failing. I think we can say that. And we're saying that in addition to taking particular policy actions, getting the Chinese to use national laws to break up North Korea Inc., those building capacity, there are those things. And then we say, well, we need to think about the problem. We need to be collecting different types of information. We need to be measuring effectiveness with different metrics. And I'm more confident on that second set than I am the former set. But I'm encouraged, too, that the Chinese reacted positively to what we said. And then we saw some arrests. Whether this will last, I don't know. But, so I'll keep an open mind on that. On being outrageous, that is awesome. It would be a waste of my time to have traveled all this way and not to have said something that was outrageous. So let me expand on it for a moment. So what is Thad? Thad is not ally reassurance. All right, so let's get that straight, first of all. The South Koreans weren't begging for Thad. This has caused them various political problems. They'll still be able to do it. But this wasn't a talking point where they were coming in every day, where's our Thad? Where's our Thad? We wanted them to have it. So it's not ally reassurance. So what is it? It's not going to stop a sea-launched medium-range ballistic missile, because it's not designed for that. I agree that it doesn't pose in its current form a threat to the D-2s or to China's nuclear force. But the Chinese who are worried about it, and there are Chinese who are worried about it, worry about it because they think this is the opening move. First it's this, and then it gets upgraded, and then it gets upgraded, and then it's really pointed at China. And certainly I've had conversations with officials. I don't know whether they represent a majority view, a minority view, whatever, outlier view, who have said this is aimed at China. I mean, they've said that to me. So, the ones...
In which country?
In this country.
Could I call a timeout on that?
Yeah, of course.
Because we could spend the rest of our time talking about that. And
I think that's a good move, moderator. Thank you for that.
Well, that's why I have the title moderator. The woman on the third row there.
Hi, Rachel Oswald, reporter with Congressional Quarterly. In the event of a Clinton administration, what advice would you give to them as they are doing a priorities review in their first month of the administration? Specifically, it seemed that what I was hearing today was a talk about better enforcement of sanctions, that we already have ample authorities on the books. And if we're talking about better enforcement, what resources are needed at Treasury and other bureaus? There was a lot of interesting information about ways to more creatively analyze these more effective Chinese middlemen. It's so interesting, but part of me is thinking, well, gosh, why haven't we done this before? Of course we should be thinking about unintended consequences. And so what in the U.S. bureaucracy has kept us from being more aware of these aspects? Thanks.
So, first off, in terms of sanctions research, it's a fantastic way to get insights in terms of how a particular policymaking group views the measures to begin with. I think what we've seen in the course of the research are two types. One, groups of policy advisors who really believe, and policymakers who really believe sanctions work, but requires more coordination and the notion that we have to be more patient, more diligent. The second group, they come out and say sanctions don't work, but in terms of political messaging and for the notion of making it look like they're doing something to particularly domestic constituencies and allies, it's very important. Within all of that, to your question, though, about as we look at a new team coming in, the priorities review, the Chinese authorities in their domestic lane have been doing things. But I don't think that part has been as investigated as closely as it could be and should be, because there are opportunities there. Right now, the notion of sanctions is usually discussed from the language of no question that it's the top priority. It then becomes a question about dosage. In a way, I don't want to put words into Jim's mouth, but the one way to look at it is for our report, we're looking at sanctions as the number two tool. And then in the top part, looking at these areas where the cooperation with the Chinese authorities to fully explore their domestic tools in terms of what they're already doing and what more can be done, I think that's an area that there is room for more work. And I think in terms of mechanisms, something like the strategic and economic dialogue could be one area where you could have some of the working start there and then breakout working groups exploring it further. So there are the mechanisms. I think it's a question of the political will to further explore it. But a lot of this work being discreet is actually very helpful. And the fact that the Chinese would come out and have more announcements like Tandong Hongshang, I think that's a great thing. And let them take the credit for it. But the end result would be increased denial of disruption of these very, very troubling partnerships between private Chinese companies and North Korean state trading companies.
I would say just very briefly on that that I think there are some bureaucratic silo issues. On our recommendations that we need to bolster our embassy staff with people from Treasury or FBI or whatever, that is a bureaucratic issue and a money issue. It's also been a money issue. There's a proposal to train more people to speak Korean. You know, for Iran, when we were dealing with Iran, there was money allocated to train more people in Farsi. That got funding. The Korean language training hasn't. So, you know, the poor embassies, I don't want to blame them because they're having to manage, from counterterrorism to trade, they're trying to manage 1,000 things and people are pulling on them. But I do think we need a higher level of integration between some of these agencies and state on the ground at the embassy. I will say, big picture, there is a notion in this town that we can coerce China's cooperation. I find that whole phrase somewhat in tension. To coerce cooperation, you can coerce, you can compel states to do stuff, you can coerce them to do stuff. Coercing to cooperate seems a longer bridge to build. And so I'm not saying we should give in and do whatever the Chinese want to do, but I'm partly, you know, at the Security Studies Program, I'm partly a realist with a capital R. I believe states act on national interest, I believe in balance of power, you know, I believe in some of these fundamental principles. And frankly, the Chinese are worried about their social stability. And that includes those three provinces with North Korea. They don't want to see collapse. Now, is there anything that we can threaten that's going to make them more worried about the threat than the worry about collapse? I don't think so. You know, so we sanction a billion of their banks. Is that more of a threat than North Korean collapse to have a failed nuclear weapon state on your border? I don't think so. So if China is the center of gravity here, you know, 90%, nothing gets done. Really, this problem doesn't get solved unless they are a willing participant. We've got to find a way. We're going to disagree, but we've got to find a way to get on the same page about some of these things. Great powers have to cooperate to solve problems. And us, you know, wagging our finger or trying to spank them is not going to get the job done.
Jonathan, do you have any?
No, I'd rather hear from you.
Okay. Just to offer a supplement to the answer, there are parts of the U.S. government on which poor schmucks like us don't know and will never know, and that's probably a good thing. The gentleman on the aisle in the middle, and then Mike.
Thank you. I'm Albert Wolf. I'm from Representative Steve Chabot's office. I'm just asking this for myself, though. I thought it was a terrific paper. I wanted to ask you two questions, and both, you know, obviously about sanctions. The first was about, you know, there's a long academic literature that argues that for authoritarian regimes in general and for, you know, import substituting regimes in particular, they benefit from sanctions. They even love it. And, you know, we can go through it. I'm just curious, you know, you spend a lot of time talking about these Chinese middlemen. How much you find that to be true in the North Korean case? The second thing I wanted to ask you about was, you know, we haven't, you know, in the past 8 years, we haven't talked at all or very much in the policy world or in academia about, you know, sort of supply side sanctions, you know, proliferation security initiative, doing things to beef up, you know, the MTCR, you know, various export control sanctions. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on doing anything about those measures to, you know, do anything about the North Korean program. And then finally, you know, the Woodrow Wilson Center came out with, they found a ton of archival work that showed that or suggested that the North Koreans basically hate the Chinese, that they hate being under their thumb. And I'm wondering what your take is on that, whether you think it's accurate. And if so, does this call for a more bilateral approach to North Korea with the U.S.? Thank you very much for that, for letting me ask that long question.
Thank you very much. Albert, to your first question about the authoritarian regime and import substitution, side way to address your question, one thing that we did early on is when we talked about North Korea, if you think of it as a pyramid, the bottom 99% wasn't a focus of the research. And we zeroed in on the top part, the 1%, and that's essentially the North Korea Inc. Population. But to respond to your question, if you look at that 1% pyramid and then increase, you know, expand that and analyze the different groups within the 1%, you have something like the uber elites and then, you know, bottom of that pyramid as well. And within that community, the application of sanctions for the uber elites, they have freedom of movement. They can travel back and forth, commercial hubs in Southeast Asia, China, and so forth. So you see this phenomenon where they import luxury items that are banned, wholesale, and then they mark it up pretty much with no limit because they don't have any competition to sell to the lower rung of the 1% and then to the top echelon of the 99%. So there's a market mechanism that I think has to be further studied, but that's a direct result of the application of sanctions that are targeted on banning luxury items. But as we mentioned earlier, if you view some of these commercial channels as a dual-use technology, once you get that mechanism going to importing banned luxury items, the concern is what else are they using that channel for? And to your point about the Chinese middlemen, and just to give you a little more color from the research interviews, this was a trial and error function. Private Chinese companies would rip off some of the North Korean state trading companies. North Korean state trading companies learned from that mistake, and that was a part of the tacit knowledge of residing and embedding in local markets. But the notion that, you know, sanctions can actually help in terms of triggering improvements of this type of phenomenon. There is something unique about that, and I think it gives a sense of how authoritarian regimes and situations like the ones between China and North Korea, very different from threatening to sanction a country that is integrated in the international community, where those type of measures can be enormously effective.
Let me briefly say that, you're absolutely right about that literature. I think the main benefit for North Korea as an authoritarian state vis-a-vis sanctions is they don't have to worry about popular reaction. Iran is not a fully democratic state. It has democratic aspects and authoritarian aspects. But the supreme leader can't completely ignore the population. And I think Chairman Kim has a lot more leeway to ignore the population. I think, you know, you might get some import substitution. I don't know. It seems like it's so fragile as a state. I don't know. I would say, in terms of relative weight of variables, it's the price of coal and commodities that probably matter more than anything else in terms of, you know, what they're at and what their level of development and wealth will be. On the PSI and MTCR and the supply side, totally support those, absolutely support those. Anything we can do in that, the more the better. I think the South Koreans have been very creative in their diplomacy, you know, full court press, going to all these governments and trying to get them on board. Very innovative, very supportive. But again, most of the trade's with China. There's no solving this problem without dealing with China. It's China, China, China. And if you solve the China thing, then you solve the problem. If you don't solve the China thing, you don't solve the problem, even though I think it's worth any amount of denial is worthwhile. So all those things are to be recommended. Do the North Koreans hate the Chinese? In my experience, the answer is yes. I mean, when I was in North Korea, They essentially said that they hated them. They would say on one side they are brothers in blood through the revolution, whatever, and then they would say things like, you guys are all great powers, the U.S. and China are going to cut a deal, we're, you know, mice surrounded by elephants, you're going to screw us. So I think this is a relationship based on national interest, and there's not a lot of love here, but both sides are crystal clear about what the national interest is, and I think the North Koreans are very, very good at seeing how their vulnerability can be used as leverage against others.
Okay. You have a comment? Okay. Mike, right here. And I'll go there and there.
Hi, Mike Macedic, PBS Online NewsHour. Jim, first of all, in your previous answer, you addressed the most burning political question in Washington by suggesting that we send the FBI director to North Korea. But I want to ask all three of you, particularly since James has mentioned the Iran playbook thing, if the key issue is getting China, or how does one move China from what seems to be their position, and all three of you, I want to address this to, how does one persuade them that there is something other than the stability of the North Korean regime is their primary objective as we pursue proliferation diplomacy?
I think it's very, very important here not to be distracted by sometimes what are official Chinese commentary. We have to listen to the other voices, sometimes authoritative voices that are embedded in the system, but for whatever set of reasons, political or otherwise, they don't have the latitude yet to fully make their case. I think fundamentally, I mean, one of the weaknesses of our broad policy is that we assume the way to force choices on Pyongyang goes through Beijing. Now, if that is the case, or at least something that you want to tinker with as a possibility, you have to ask, are there better ways that we can to, in essence, engage China privately and confidentially? And let me emphasize the confidentially. I mean, that's part of the problem, frankly, that everyone talks too much about this. And if we're going to have a successful, different kind of strategy to deal with this problem of North Korea, if I could call it just a problem, it's something much more than simply a problem, it will require enormous discipline with our own policy process. It will require us not to publicly shame the Chinese. It will require an open acknowledgement that the failures on strategy towards North Korea are shared failures and begins with the very character of the system itself. And most fundamentally, and here again, I do see things that point in this direction, it's the growing recognition in China that North Korea represents to China a security danger. In the past, that was very, very rarely intimated. Over time, it seeps into a lot of the conversations we have and even into some of their public statements. And that needs to be nurtured, but it has to begin, I think, with a fresh start with the next administration under President Next that will be very, very carefully calibrated and not with all the emphasis on the banner headlines. You'll get nowhere fast with China on that basis.
I endorse all those comments, especially the need for discretion. We're not going to persuade China to squeeze North Korea, you know, cut off coal and iron ore exports or squeeze them to the point where it would risk their collapse. That ain't going to happen. But the Chinese have been super clear that they support denuclearization. And North Korea causes them a lot of foreign policy headaches. If it wasn't for the fact that their collapse would threaten the single most important vital interest that China has, we would probably be able to get a lot more done on this. So the question is, we're not going to be able to go all that way, but they're willing to, I think they're probably willing to try to, at least some part of the bureaucracy is willing to entertain the notion that there can be coordination to stop WMD procurement, that is denial. sanctions as denial, as opposed to coercion or bargaining chips or those other things that I outlined. You know, every time they launch a weapon, the South Koreans and the Japanese, there are voices for nuclear weapons. Every time they launch, the North Koreans launch a weapon, it pulls the U.S. closer to their allies. It keeps them in the region. There's nothing good here for China. And so I think they do, honest, and they've been quite forthright in saying they want denuclearization. So we should work with them on on freezing the program where it is so it doesn't get any bigger. You know, they are past a certain threshold, but they don't have a secure second strike. Let's work with them so this program is retarded until we have, and slowed down and stopped till we have a political opportunity to begin to freeze it and roll it back. But that's where our interests are the same. We shouldn't have to persuade them. They see that as an interest. And John has said they don't want, you know, the North Koreans to counterfeit all those funds, to pour in drugs, you know, to add to all their other problems. So I think we can have a discussion, a rational discussion about what our mutual interests are here, and that won't lead to big radical changes, but it could lead to some important progress.
John? Okay. The gentleman over there in the middle on the wall.
Hi, my name is Ben, and I'm from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So I had a question. From China's perspective, is there a red line in terms of North Korea's nuclear weapons program? Is there a red line where North Korea, once crosses that line of nuclear weapons development, China will really squeeze down the North Korean regime? Thank you.
I'm just going to say that Foreign Minister Wang Yi actually used the red line label at his annual press conference after the National People's Congress several years ago. He didn't say, however, what that red line was, but he did use the phrase, which I found in its own right quite interesting. So there's some awareness, but they've not really specified it. I suppose you could say if North Korea decided to specifically target its weapons against China, it might give them some pause. But in fact, I would argue that North Korea's fundamental nuclear weapons strategy is what President de Gaulle used to call a tout-azimut strategy, and that involves, it's directed at everyone, including China. And that's anything we can do to sort of get some serious conversation with China on that basis, to recognize that it is a region-wide and potentially more than region-wide problem that needs to be analyzed. If I could just add one other point here, necessarily we're talking about the U.S. and China here. We haven't talked a lot about the ROK. And one of the problems right now, to say the least, is as President Park's approval rating drops stunningly to, in authoritative polls, to 5%, we need a credible, strong response from the Korean government. And they need to be involved deeply in these discussions because it is, after all, the Korean Peninsula, not the American Peninsula, not the Chinese Peninsula, certainly not the Japanese Peninsula. And that's one of the other added dilemmas. We've got a very, very weakened government, to say the least, entering its last year in power, if it can persist. And it just adds more of the complexity to this as we go into a new administration here in the United States.
If I could just add, interestingly, I think when you frame that question of a red line for the Chinese, it's probably directed to South Korea and the United States over THAAD. Some of the terminology that we heard over the summer as well, THAAD and what THAAD represents, you know, that visceral reaction from the Chinese side and also the Chinese pressure on South Korea over THAAD is, I think, a top priority for the new administration coming in as well. But directly to your point about this notion of a red line as it pertains from China to North Korea, right now, North Korea's WMD programs, ballistic missile tests, nuclear tests, but particularly ballistic missile tests, are framed by countries as well as the UN Security Council resolutions as a threat to international security. Now, these long-range ballistic missile tests, the last long range went all the way north of the Philippines. Now, for a country that it's still building in terms of their technology aspect of long-range missile guidance and so forth, if something were to happen and it flew astray and it was framed as a threat to international safety, you know, a missile debris field that goes to Chinese territorial waters or something like that, I think that's where the Chinese reaction would change. And then this notion of applying pressure through their own means directly to North Korea to cease and desist that type of testing. That would be different. That would be new.
If I could add to this my current hobby horse, despite all of North Korea's outrageous behavior, there are two norms that they have yet to violate with respect to nuclear weapons development, and they could. The first would be an atmospheric test of their boosted weapon. It's not a thermonuclear weapon, but it is a hydrogen weapon. And I wouldn't preclude that under all circumstances, because if you're going to prove what you claim to have, there's only one way to do it. And the other, of course, and this is related to some extent to what John just talked about, would be the possibility of a missile test with a nuclear warhead on top. But again, something launched from North Korea. There is a window straight southward that you could use for those purposes. There has not been an atmospheric test or a missile test in 36 years. 1980 was the last Chinese test. And it might be that that's something that would really provoke much sharper reactions from China, because that would be something almost unprecedented. And assuming it worked. If it didn't work, well, let's not go there.
The woman there, this may be the last question, but we'll try.
Hi, I'm Gutierrez, the research fellow at the Plowshares Fund. And to me, it seems that one unintended consequence that you didn't mention is that, at least it seems that North Korea is also responding to sanctions by having more nuclear and missile tests, like to show that they are not having an effect. Don't you think that this is also a problem of U.S. diplomacy? And I mean, I understand that you're focusing on sanctions, but can you really distinguish the two, especially because the diplomacy seems to be focused on denuclearization, and from the sanctions perspective, I mean, and realistically, that's already too late, and you're talking about a freeze. So do you think this dual track of sanctions and diplomacy is really working that well?
Let me just briefly say that I'm often asked questions, why is North Korea doing X? And I am almost never able to answer that question, because there are way more theories than there are facts. So why did North Korea conduct a given test? Well, you know, it's an anniversary. They're in the middle of a testing program. They want to show that sanctions don't matter. I heard someone on the UN panel of experts say that they thought they were increasing tests because they were afraid that sanctions would matter, and they want to get in as many as possible before they run out of stuff. I mean, I have no idea. I can only judge by the number and the quality of what's happening. You know, obviously we are supporters of, speaking for myself anyway, I'm a supporter of diplomacy. I don't think it's too late for denuclearization, a DNI clapper notwithstanding. I've heard the North Koreans say everything, literally everything about their nuclear. We're going to use it. We're not going to use it. We're going to have it. We're not going to have it. No first use. If you smile, if you frown at us, we'll hit you. I've heard them say everything. So I never say never with respect to North Korea, even denuclearization. I do think this about diplomacy, though, and I will end with this. The irony here from bargaining theory and great power politics is we need China to cooperate with us, but simultaneously, and here's the trick of the thing, they have to cooperate with us while they maintain a adequate, if not reasonable, relationship with North Korea. Why do I say that? If we're going to have any diplomatic agreement that works, the North Koreans aren't going to believe that we're going to follow through on our side of the agreement. Whether they're justified in thinking that or not, they're not. They need, like anyone in their bargaining space would need, they need a great power guarantor that says, if you agree to do all this stuff, don't worry, you'll get the rewards. Don't worry, we'll take care of you. And there's only one country that can be a great power guarantor for a nuclear agreement with North Korea, and that country is China. So if their relationship goes down the toilet, any diplomatic alternative goes with it. So we have to, it's really threading a needle here politically. That's why John and I like this idea of using Chinese domestic law aimed at Chinese nationals, so they don't have to sort of spit on the North Koreans even as they go after their W&D procurement to maintain this political relationship.
If I could just add, Jim, it's kind of ironic what you just said, and you gave a different answer than I thought you were going to give, because if you believe what the North Koreans say, the great power guarantor they want is the United States of America.
In a way, that's really true, too.
Okay. In the back, is it a short question?
Yes.
Okay.
Want to ask about another aspect of criminality by North Korea, and that is its crimes against humanity. Can that be used as a point of leverage against China in that they are aiding and abetting in ways with these crimes?
I think what you raised is a very important one, but I just want to refer, and it's not to deflect answering it, but for the scope of this project, as Jim mentioned, the different applications of sanctions, to your question, that was one of the applications of sanctions. We look very specifically at denial strategies and ways to boost different policy tools so that this type of activity is slowed down or halted, ideally. Do you want to?
No, I feel bad. Obviously, this is super important. You know, crimes against humanity, it's the phrase sort of speaks for itself. And so I take this very seriously. But it's not, I don't have anything to offer on this, knowing nothing about Chinese views about human rights, foreign policy, or about human rights more generally. I've just stayed in my lane and worked on the nuclear. But I want to recognize that this is obviously, fundamentally important to us as an international society. So I'm sympathetic, but I don't have an answer.
Well, we've had programs on that subject in the past. We will have more in the future, I promise you. One is in the works. But I want to thank you all for the work that you do in your lane. It's really nice to see people passionate about their subject because there's a lot of work still yet to do, and we're all better off if you're doing it. So thank you very much. Thank you all for coming.